Everyone, and welcome to minute 130 of season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off the week is Matthew Simpson, a freelance film and television critic. Welcome back to the show, Matthew.
Glad to be here. It's been a great week so far. I'm looking forward to finishing it up.
Yeah. We're getting ready. The tension is rising, little by little. and they do it really well, and they don't even need a fake mechanical shark to do it. Spielberg has learned stuff in 23 years that he add on to what he did beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, he is probably the greatest to ever do it. And I feel like this film is the culmination of that.
Do you think this is one of his last great movies?
No, I think he continues to make great movies to this day. And I think it's interesting the way we speak about Spielberg these days, actually, in that, like, if you saw The Post or Bridge of Spies or his West Side Story remake, and it was literally any other director, I think the world would have gone absolutely nuts for them. But because they're all Spielberg movies, people are like, yeah, well, that's just the kind of movie he makes now. It's really interesting because they're all amazing films that we severely underrate because they're him, because he's just such a genius. It's a very interesting thing that happens around him these days.
Yeah, that's true. I agree. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Fablemans. Same thing. You know, it's something that...
I mean, the Fablemans is a great example of what a great artist he is as a filmmaker. It was my favorite movie that year. And the reason for that is that is a movie that very much could have been Look How Great I Am. But what it actually is why am I this way? And I think that's a really interesting question for an artist to ask themselves, much less to commit it to film and release it wide to the world.
Right. Certain things you keep to yourself. It's like those rose bushes, wife with the rose bushes.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
So it's interesting that, it was my favorite movie of 2022 also, the Fablemans.
Yeah, great film. And a great David Lynch cameo too.
Yes, it really was. I was surprised he didn't get, at least an Oscar nomination as supporting actor for that. You know, Judd Hirsch deserved it. So I'm not saying he didn't, but David Lynch's was great also, because it was so different from what you would expect, and it's something that Hollywood likes. Hollywood likes patting itself on the back. You know, so oh well. Unfortunately,
legacy type awards.
Yeah. That's right, but there won't be any more, unfortunately, any more David Lynch performances like that. Okay, so minute 130 begins with Miller giving some info to Upham, and ends with Horvath peeking out from his little hiding place. So yesterday we ended things with the men getting prepared for this this upcoming skirmish battle, firefight, however you want to refer to it. And as the minute was ending, Miller was basically taking out his clip and probably hopefully putting a new clip in. But at the same time, we saw Upham just land inside of the area that Miller's the sinkhole or impact crater that he's staying there, and then Upham like falls into this crater, and Miller just continues with what he's doing. He's putting a new clip into his gun, and he's just talking to Upham, and he goes, "Corporal Upham," and he goes, "Yes, sir." He says, "We don't have a 30 caliber machine gun in this position. Either Mr. Mellish or Mr. Jackson in the bell tower needs that." He goes, "Yes, sir." So again, it goes back to what I was talking about yesterday, that this is completely Hollywoodized. There's no way that English or Jackson at this point in the firefight need someone to bring them more ammo. They should have as much ammo as they possibly could need, at their positions, getting ready to shoot them. So
Yeah.
as you said yesterday, it's a reason to make up and run around. That's more or less what it comes down to.
It's to make him run around, and also, like, in this particular moment, so like he doesn't really get what's going on in the way that he needs to. Just the urgency. It also helps us establish a little better. I think it's pretty well established already, but it also helps to establish, like, the geography of the scene just by like taking a moment to explain where a couple of people are. So I think it really works for the film, but yeah, by this point they should all have their bullets. That's just, yeah, there's no reason for them not to.
And one of the things that I like about this also is that Miller refers to Mellish and Jackson as misters. You should either find Mr. Mellish or Mr. Jackson. It makes it sound as if he's a concierge, and so it's just funny the way that he says it.
Yeah, and just I like
I
the
don't know if it's meant in a tongue in cheek type of way, the way that he's saying it.
Yeah, I think it's just a nice little nod of like respect that these are men,
Sure.
gentlemen. As it,
Yeah.
I like that he takes the moment to use the honorific in this particular time.
Right. Okay. That's fair. And then so Upham gets the bandoliers ready again, puts them back over his neck, and starts leaves and starts running. And then he's seen by Horvath, who says, "Upham, Jackson's fine. Turn around to Mellish." And he points points in the direction to the left. Now, what I love about this is the way that Horvath acts here. Because Horvath is a few meters away from, or a few feet away, whatever you want to refer to it, from this conversation at the beginning of this minute between Upham and Miller. But Horvath is like a great sergeant, a great platoon sergeant. He knows what's going on. He's on the ball. So he knows that right away he's going to say to Upham, "Okay, Upham, you need to go to, you need to go find Mellish. Don't go where Jackson is." He just by looking at him, he knows that he knows what Miller eventually just said to him without having to officially hear what he said. And I
Yeah,
just
he
love the
clearly
way that they show it.
knows. Sorry, yeah, he clearly knows what's going on and where people need to be, and it's a great, just a little moment for him. Yeah, as like a guy who's like good at his job, I agree. It's a really nice little moment.
Because again, you were not sure. We're not 100% sure he heard Miller say it, but he's looking at Upham. He's like, "Upham, you're over here. You're carrying the stuff for the 30 caliber. Okay, which direction are you going? You're going towards the tower. All right, Jackson doesn't need it. Go find Mellish." That type of thing. And it's just great. It tells us so much about the character of Horvath, which we've seen over and over throughout this movie, the way that he acts as a platoon sergeant. Basically covering everybody and making sure that everyone is doing things the way that they should be doing. Even Miller sometimes. He has no problem telling Miller when he's wrong also about certain things.
Yeah.
So it's just great the way that they do that. And then the then we see that Upham at that point runs off towards Milch's position, and we can start hearing in the background lots of gunfire. That's once again, you've mentioned this a few times over the last few days about how great the sound design is here. Again, we don't see the bullets, but we hear the machine gun fire, in the background. as it's getting closer and closer and stuff like that.
Yeah, and you can definitely
And
hear it approaching as well. It's not like it's not
yes.
just static. It's you can tell that it's getting closer, which is a nice touch.
And then we see in the distance, the rabbit coming back at like full speed. And we see that Miller and Ryan actually see it coming towards them, coming really close. And then from that point, we see the shot changes, and we see what looks like a wine bottle. What could someone need a wine bottle for at this point? And then we see that they're pouring stuff into it. And, here they're making Molotov cocktails. We can see on the ledge that there are at least three that are already, set up, plus another, two that they're currently working on and stuff like that, which is great.
So it is interesting to me that at this point that those Molotov cocktails aren't already made, though.
That goes back to what we've been talking about all week, about that these things should have been ready beforehand. I don't get it either. it's another, I guess they want us to see that they're making the Molotov cocktails. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe they want to show off the bartending, hijinks of these two guys.
Yeah, maybe. It is a nice moment, though. Like, it does serve to heighten the tension. Like, it works for the film. So, I'm willing to let like all of these nitpicks slide, basically, because of that.
Okay. All right. So, what do you know about Molotov cocktails?
I mean, other than the basics, that it's a bottle full of some kind of flammable liquid that you throw and it bursts and sets stuff on fire. That's what I know about.
Yeah, usually it's a bottle or some sort of container filled with some sort of flammable substance and equipped with some type of fuse for it to explode.
Yeah, and, classic being like a damp rag or something like that.
Exactly. You light the fuse and the weapon is thrown, and then as it breaks, it causes flames and stuff like that. It doesn't explode, but it causes a lot of fires and stuff like that. They're usually improvised weapons because they are obviously something that is very simple to make. And they can be used by a whole variety of things. They can be used by criminals, gangsters, rioters, football hooligans, urban guerrillas, terrorists, irregular soldiers, freedom fighters, and even regular soldiers, like in this movie. They states in this article that the reason that regular soldiers would use it is if it's usually due to a shortage of equivalent military issued ammunition.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. They're usually not things that are improvised in the field, but there are places which will mass produce them, so that you have them ready during combat and stuff like that. And so where do you think the name Molotov cocktail comes from?
Sure sounds Russian, but other than that, I don't know.
Okay, so it was actually named in 1939 by Finnish soldiers, because the Russian foreign minister's name was Molotov.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was propaganda. That they there was propaganda that Molotov produced during the where he declared that the on Soviet radio that incendiary bombing missions over Finland were actually airborne humanitarian food deliveries for their starving neighbors, when in reality they were dropping bombs on them. So the Finns decided to start calling the bombs that they that the Soviets were dropping Molotov breadbaskets.
Huh.
And then when they decided, when people, when someone thought of the idea of, you know, firebombing Soviet tanks, so they decided to call it a Molotov cocktail, which was a drink that would go well with the food parcels that he was delivering.
That is, yeah. This all is making perfect sense to me.
Yeah, it's actually hilarious.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing that if you wrote it into a novel, someone would tell you to tone it down.
Probably.
But it works because it's a real story.
Yes. So there are many other names for a Molotov cocktail. There, it's known as a bottle bomb, a bottle grenade, a burn bottle, a burning bottle, a fire bomb, a fire bottle, a flame bomb, a flame bottle, a gasoline bomb or gas bomb, incendiary bottle, a molly, which is commonly used in video games. Sometimes it's just referred to as a Molotov. Sometimes it's a petrol bomb. Sometimes it's known as the poor man's grenade. And in Spanish, it's known as a punch, which means to punch, or like a, or pancho. So, yeah. It's very interesting, the whole history of a Molotov cocktail. But yeah. I think you're right. People would say that you should tone it down, even though it's a great story.
It's legitimately, yeah, it's a funny story, but yeah, it's all of these things have really interesting histories.
Yeah. Yeah, it is mostly known for being a symbol of civil uprising or revolution. And it has become very popular in modern culture, and is therefore used quite often in video games.
Yep.
You know, as a way to thwart the enemy, I guess you can say. So, yeah, very cool. So yeah, but more so than just showing us these two guys creating the Molotov cocktails, is that we get a shot from the balcony of where they're on, you know, where we see the rabbit get closer, you know, and just pass by them with Ryben holding on to the back for dear life, you know, that he doesn't fall off this little contraption. So again, it goes back to what you were talking about it gives us the geography of what's going on. And then we see that the rabbit gets close to where Miller and Ryan are situated. It slows down a little bit, and Ryben gets off of it, and then he runs over and jumps into the area with Miller and Upham. Sorry, with Miller and Ryan. And it's funny because like Miller protects Ryan from Ryben jumping in to this crater.
Mm-hmm.
You notice that? It's just very funny how he shields him for a second. I guess showing that he's gonna do what he can to keep him safe. Even from someone like Ryben.
Yeah, or from anything he just doesn't see coming. Like if he can't verify it, he's gonna cover him.
Ryben at this point then gives more information as to what's going on. He goes, "There's a ton of infantry, Captain. I don't know if they took the bait, though." We start hearing the tanks getting closer, and we see the three men, hiding by as they start, seeing the sound or hearing the sounds get closer and closer, and they start getting they start pointing their weapons in the direction of where the sounds are coming from, which obviously they know where it's supposed to be coming from, so they're pointing it in that direction. And as they're doing that, see like a quick little shot of the camera shows in front of them, and we see Mike's head just pop up for a second there. which is also great to see the way that just fits in there.
I love right at the end of this minute too, there's a little detail that I guess it's technically the beginning of the next minute, but where the ground is shaking and Mike moves a single stone out of the way. It's a nice little detail of him, like just caring about his surroundings and trying to optimize what he his space in that particular moment while the earth is literally shaking around him. It's a great little moment.
It really is. And one of the things that I love also is they when they show us the five men that are taking cover. So you have Ryan Miller and Ryben and two other guys who we don't who are I guess red shirts. And the camera pans across them really well. Just to give us an idea that okay, these guys are the ones that are holding the fort down, basically. And it's just it looks great the way that shot just pans across. I really like that.
Yeah, and this is really the end of the sort of the deep breath before the plunge, right? Like everything kicks off. Well, for you, it'll be on Monday. This is the last moment of peace before the big final battle of the movie. I think I've said it before a couple times this whole week. But like this whole sequence, everything leading up to it, last week's minutes and this week's minutes in particular are some of my favorite in the movie. Despite the military inaccuracies we've highlighted, I think dramatically it's one of the most successful
Okay, but
parts of the
that
movie.
doesn't take away from the movie.
Yeah.
I'm not concerned about that. Not at all. Yeah, this is a great week. Nicely enough. And that's all I have to say about this week and this episode. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, that's pretty much it. This, continues to be, these minutes continue to be a master class in tension building. And I think that they really, this moment that we just spoke about really caps that off well. And I'm excited to listen to your episodes next week where you actually get into the actual battle sequence.
Me too. So every Friday we have a segment called Filmmaker Friday, where my guest will give their top five Steven Spielberg directed films. So I know we've talked about this, over this week, especially a little bit earlier today. I know this will not be an easy one for you to do, also, but I have faith in you.
Yeah, it's t another tough one because the man has made so many masterpieces. But starting at the bottom with number five, I'm going to go with West Side Story, which feels like a movie that he waited his entire life to make. Probably because it's a movie that he waited his entire life to make. And for me personally, it begs the question, why has he not been making musicals this whole time? Because it is an incredible watch. Kind of surprised he
Not
didn't do
only that,
better
but
at
he
every
takes.
awards show.
Yeah, I'm very surprised at that also. I mean, bottom line is that the way that he was able to take a already established musical that won Best Picture and won a whole bunch of other Oscars, back in 1961, and make it even better. It
Yeah.
just it blows my mind. It's one of those movies that I can watch over and over. And I'm a big fan of the original also, but
Oh yeah.
I like his version better
I
because it gives us more about the character.
Yeah, and it's also just on a technical level. Like it gives more about the characters. I think the way it mixes up when and where certain songs happen, in particular Cool Boy, is much more in keeping with the sort of spirit of the what those songs are trying to do. But then just the way he like moves the camera is just incredible. There's so many great big long takes. He does a thing that if you ever listen to me speak on podcasts or read any of my writing about action movies, one of the things I complain about is how a lot of modern filmmakers don't. They cut sort of too fast and too close, and I just wish they would pull the camera back and let me watch what's happening. And Spielberg does that in this movie. He just pulls the camera back. He moves it around a lot in ways that are dynamic and fit with what he's trying to show. But like oftentimes you're seeing a big ensemble of people doing an amazing song and dance number, and you can just watch the whole thing. And it's incredible watch. I can't speak highly enough about it. So that was my number five, right? So I am going to jump to something a little more contemporary. For my number four, I'm going to go with The Post, which might be a controversial take. I don't know. But I really enjoy films that highlight journalists, good journalists doing good journalism. And The Post is definitely one of those. It's masterfully directed. It's another great Tom Hanks performance. It's a great Meryl Streep performance. It's an important story highlighting the, I was going to say importance, but I've said that too much, but just the, like, the required nature of a free press in a modern society, and the role that they play. And just to highlight how good of a director Spielberg is and how good of a performer both Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep are, the big cathartic release in this movie involves a man putting several newspapers on a table. And that does sound super boring, but like it works so well. I love this movie so much. I don't really know what I want to do for my number three, because there's so many good ones to choose from. But because we've already talked about The Fabelmans, I think I'm going to swap in something else just to make sure it gets mentioned. And that is Munich, which is the story of sort of the aftermath of the, was it 1972 Olympic massacre? Yep. And yes, the Israeli Special Forces team that comes together to hunt down the perpetrators of that. It feels like a very personal film, to me at least. And it's another one that asks a lot of questions about like what is right and what do we give up to be right and what do we have to sacrifice for the right thing. And turns out Eric Bana is a great actor, and the supporting cast is also all great actors. And it's one of the darker entries in his filmography, but it's one that I really appreciate. And then for number two and number one, it's going to be Jaws and Jurassic Park. I feel like those movies don't need a lot of explanation, except to say that Jaws is the blockbuster of the film. You know, he changed filmmaking, modern summer filmmaking, forever with that movie. But then with Jurassic Park, I believe I mentioned before, Jurassic Park is the movie that made me fall in love with movies. So I don't know that it is, I don't know that it's his best movie, but it is my favorite of his movies, because it's the one that I looked up at as a 12-year-old and went, yes, like movies. Movies are magic. This is the one. This is the one that made me know that movies are magic. And so I've been hooked on it ever since.
Yeah, but unfortunately, all the subsequent films are not as good as the first Jurassic Park. Yeah.
That is true. I would argue that some of them are better than others, but
some of them are better than others, but none of them are better than the original.
It's a great book too, actually. It's a great exercise, yes, adaptation if you read the book and watch the movie to catch the differences and why they made them. But yeah, that is the movie that made me fall in love with movies. And I love it. I love it a lot.
All right. Very cool. All right. Thank you very much for that list. So, Matthew, would you like for one final time this season to tell me and tell everyone else how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah. The easiest way, again, is to find me on the social medias. You can find me at SmatthewAF in most places, but most frequently on Threads and Blue Sky. You can also find all my recent podcast appearances and writing on my personal portfolio website, which is stretched.ca. And then last but not least, you can also check out the Critics Association that I helped co-found in late 2022. That is the Cascadia Film and Television Critics Association. You'll find me and also a host of other great critics from the Cascadia region of North America at cascadiacritics.com.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Bennett. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobbennett.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobbennett@movierob.net. So, Matthew, thank you very much for joining me this week. It's been great. A lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed yourself, too.
I did. It's a lot of fun. Great movie. Great conversation. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. All right. And I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But everyone have a great weekend. And until then, earn this.
Earn this. In my solitude, you haunt me. Reveries of days gone by.